And we're back here at Left Turn on Bird Street, KRBS 107.1, low power FM in Oroville, California. We're talking to Chuck Smith, a union representative. On the board is Mary Ann Norzer, the actual...
and she does great work.
Co-founder, almost practically, of the station. We are now online at we're web streamed. You can get us. And that's good news or bad news, depending on what your point of view is. And you can just go to our website, www.radiobirdstreet.org. And there's a button there you could click, and we'll pop right up. And I suggest you play us really loud so that your neighbors can hear it, and then thereby learn how good we are over here. And then also, and that's how it works. And you can call for some comment, if you'd like to make one, on the things we're talking about by calling 530, if you happen to be in St. Louis, or locally, 534-1200. So the whole number is 530-534-1200. And
is that 530-534-1200?
That's... all those numbers are in there someplace. Anyway, we're moving a little bit away from the labor issues. We're still on economic issues with... I'm actually ripping myself off here. I did a little web item for our site at ltobs.blogspot.com. And America as hamburger stand from us. America is in a sorry economic situation, I noted, as probably everybody else realizes. We are rapidly being separated into two classes, servers and managers of servers. Imagine America as a hamburger stand with no customers, just a bunch of servers, a few managers, and no customers. Our drive-up window has been closed. Under the watchful eye of high-paid managers, the low-paid. I'm sorry, to say low-powered.
Well, whoever wrote that really made it difficult to read.
You know, you writing for web and writing for radio is a different thing. The low-paid servers serve each other. Pre-made hamburgers shipped in from Malaysia or someplace to be reheated in China-made microwave ovens. Economist Paul Craig Roberts, a guy I read very frequently at Counterpunch on the web, and you should read too, puts it this way. Now, this guy is a very conservative economist, not a libby. He says, not a single one of these new U.S. jobs that he's mentioned before produces a tradable good or service that can be exported or serve as an import substitute to help reduce the massive and growing U.S. trade deficit. The U.S. economy is employing people to sell things, to move people around, and to serve them fast food and alcoholic beverages. The items may have an American brand name, but they are mainly made offshore. For example, 70% of Walmart's goods are made in China. Where are the jobs for the 65,000 engineers, the U.S. graduates that the U.S. graduates each year? Where are the jobs for the physics, chemistry, and math majors? Who needs a university degree to wait tables and serve drinks, to build houses, to work as hospital orderlies, bus drivers, and sales clerks? In the 21st century, job growth in the U.S. economy has consistently reflected that of a third world country. Low productivity domestic services jobs. This goes on month after month, and no one catches on, least of all the economists and the policymakers. You say we can't even afford the McMaul burger because the managers have raised the price, but not your pay? And that's what Chuck takes care of. A caller from India will be sure to ring you up at dinner time to tell you to pay up anyway, or your line of credit will be canceled. Now, isn't that pretty much how it's going on? That's how it's affecting me. I can't even get a job at McDonald's.
Now, are we actually going to have a caller from India call up the show?
You know, they can. They have big phone operations there, 800 numbers, so they can call me up at dinner time.
Well, you know, this story, Tom, you know, you let off.
Oh, I got to make one point. I go on with them because of from some phone problems, and I want them to answer a question. And you can tell it's a foreign person in a foreign location. They're not. You say, "Where are you located?" They won't tell you. But anyway, so you get one guy or girl and talk to them, and you're not getting any place because you've been through it once before. And then you get, let me connect you with my supervisor. And then, of course, that doesn't work out because they're all new. You know, they finally you get somebody. It turns out you're talking to an American to actually solve the problem. So you can see what they're doing. Actually, that'll change. Anyway, I got myself in a box there. I don't know what I was going to say. I was going to say something intelligent. I promised myself. Chuck, any comments on that?
No, but I got a comment on your story.
Oh. Oh, I mean the story, not me. I don't care about me.
You you let off with the anniversary of the Solidarity movement in Poland, and it had me thinking about the attempts at organizing workers in other countries, because that's the reason that we're just a service industry in the United States. Is obviously all our work is going out to other countries, and China, they're getting paid 12 cents a day, and that is labor's biggest challenge. And you know, we talked about the split with AFL-CIO. Labor really needs to organize worldwide. It's difficult though. In South and Central America during Ronald Reagan's era, and before that too, but particularly during Ronald Reagan's era, we were spending tax dollars to kill union organizers. They called them communists in South and Central America. But the people that were dying were working people. They were peasants. They were a lot of the natives in the Central and South American countries. And our official policy was to train, send tax dollars to train police to kill organizers at banana plants. Coca-Cola killed two union organizers at one plant in Central America. So we got rid of our Coca-Cola machines out of our office in Yuba City. That was our big way to do it, and I try to avoid Coca-Cola products at all costs. But we're going to continue to be just a service industry. We're not going to have any jobs as long as workers in other countries are not organized by unions. So, but if you tell them how bad unions are in these other countries, it'll never happen. They're just going to turn around and...
Well, you know, you bring up a really interesting point that I've been trying to make and have made several times with Dan here on the air, is the worldwide movement. There's a group called World Socialist Forum, and it started about 8 years ago, I think, and they meet every other year in places like Brazil, India, whatever, and they bring thousands of people from NGOs, that's non-governmental organizations, and labor unions, and individuals interested in a people movement to make a worldwide web of information for workers as and individuals and just regular people, as opposed to individual governments controlling individual sets of people in different countries.
Sounds like that's all a union. People getting together and doing things.
That's a great
idea.
Those
are all unions. Yeah.
You know, if I could afford to fly to India, I'd attend that one.
The Chamber of Commerce, by the way, is a union. I mean, anytime you have groups coming together, people coming together for a common cause, you have a union. Now,
well, this is, you know, we hear the same problem with voters in general. You've run campaigns. The 30%, if that, people vote. Why people? The voters are basically a large union. It's a customer union, I guess, for. Or a customer group for
some of those voters are nothing but sheep.
They don't want to.
Well, no, they. You know how Karl Rove made his money.
Oh, sheep! I thought you said cheap. I was going to say, what does it cost to get to the polling station?
No. You know how Karl Rove made his money?
Running crooked campaigns in Florida and Texas, and I think Georgia too.
No. He in direct mail. I mean, he sent junk mail to Americans. A guy who sent junk mail to Americans is now chief of staff for George Bush. I mean, to me, that says more about America than probably anything.
Well, he could raise money, and that's the whole art to politics. If you can bring in the money, you can. Here we go. A call.
Don't want to lose that point though about we need to organize worldwide.
I agree with you. I think that's why you don't need a lot of little, and they've served their purpose, and they continue to serve their purpose. But I'd like to see either a whole workers' class, IWW kind of mass movement by the underclass to put an end to an overclass.
In every movement throughout the United States history, about the world history, there's been a few people doing it. Few people fighting against it, people in the middle that you've got to move. So,
oh, that's right. We have a guest, Irv Neuser, and he is going to give us some thoughts on what we've just been saying, and I hope some of them are good. Go ahead, Irv.
Hi, am I there on air?
Yep.
Okay. Just on that last comment, Tom. Does that mean that you would join a union if there was an IWW?
You know, if there was a union that applied to me and that let me in and I could still get paid, yeah, I'd join it. I have no objection to that. It's the ones that say you can join, you can pay your dues, but we're not going to get you a job because that's gone to the guy came in ahead of you.
Yeah.
The IWW still exists.
Right.
You know, and you can't find it. Where's the local union hall?
They don't have one. They're anarchic, remember.
Well, you know, I've told people on the air that Dan is a liberal. I am an anarchist. That's how you've got to understand what I'm a humorous or attempt to be humorous anarchist.
They closed the IWW district office in Marysville, Yuba City after they convicted two of their organizers as for murder in the Wheatland Hop Riot in 1913.
And these two guys just happened to be there.
They were at least 45 yards away from where the shots were fired.
Arrest. I mean, that always reminded me. There was in the hop yards in the near the town of Wheatland in California at one time back in the early 1900s. This would be in about 1909 to 18, somewhere in there. They grew hops. That's the stuff you hear about being in beer. And it was used in other products at the time. It was a big crop. And all the farm workers, this is a depression going on then too, came to pick the hops. And then, I forget the exact circumstances, but the growers had promised them, I think, 3 cents a bushel. And when they got there, they said, we'll only give you 1.5 cents or something like that.
And if there's a single stem in there, we're not going to pay you at all. We're going to keep everything you've picked, but if there's a stem in there, you don't get paid.
So there was an objection to this, and it led to a riot, and the Yuba County Sheriff went down there to enforce the management's point of view, and in the course of that, two of the manager types were killed, right?
Yeah, it was
the sheriff, I think.
Essentially,
was
a police riot. You had a guy from the Department of Fish and, well, who didn't have a Department of Fish and Game then, but he was a game warden. And he went wandering into the crowd with his gun, firing off the pistol, because the IWW folks actually had that, you know, gumption to sing songs, and they went to visit the employer, and they asked for toilets because there had like 2,500 people there, and they had 7 holes dug in the ground. They had the only fluids that were being provided in 110 degree heat. Was a citric acid lemonade sold by a cousin, and
that's a good organization point. I think that we have somebody on the line. Irv, we forgot all about him. Irv,
yeah,
you were telling us something.
Set you off, didn't I? Okay, I do have a comment, and that was on Proposition 186. Chuck probably remembers it back in the middle 90s when we tried to get a single pay here in California, and. The insurance business, the businessmen, the municipalities really went out all out to defeat it, and they did. I think we got about 29% of the vote. That's about it. But one thing that you mentioned, well, I think the climate's changed today. Today, I think co-payments can't be made. In those days, the guys were making and the women were making their co-payments, and they were manageable, in other words, you know, by the workers and the independent contractors who had a $1,500 deductible. Now their deductibles are sky high. So on this payroll tax, I just wanted to say that when back there in the middle 90s when Proposition 186 was being pushed around, the same people came at us with the same things that Chuck mentioned earlier, and particularly that one that workers are going to lose their jobs. And we found that workers, insurance workers, were not going to lose their jobs. And taken in others, all these health care plan would take in, single-payer health care plan would take in a lot of those workers, and those workers would still be working because, you know, insurance covers other subjects like car insurance and life insurance and mortgage insurance. So I think that issue would be something that probably ought to be checked out, given the people given some kind of percentage of what, you know, the payroll or the tax would be, and what exactly amounts of people that are going to be working in the field, so that we could say, well, wait a minute, here's how many workers this program is going to include. And that's my comment. But I'd like to ask Chuck also on another subject, and that is the AFL-CIO split. Seems like, to me, it's grunt versus municipal and public employees, the unions. When I look at the unions, how they separated, and actually, I think I get the feeling that maybe this is a move to ensure people who are out there just doing the grunt work and don't really have a trade to speak of, but are just picking up things, people in the hotel workers, people in the fields, things of this sort. In the state of California in particular, we have a large immigrant population. I think we'll probably see SEIU take over, or at least control UFCW. And so anyway, what I'm getting at is that where are the operating engineers going to be, and exactly what do you see as this movement going in the next few years?
Well, operating engineers is staying in AFL-CIO, and I don't know that I can predict where this movement's going to go. I want to say this about my experience with SEIU. The people that I know who work for SEIU are very dedicated to what they do. I think most people who work for labor organizations are very dedicated. I don't operate at the level, say, that our business manager does, and our officers. You're right that there's a lot of changing demographics in the workforce, and the minority involvement in unions is something that is difficult, because I don't believe most unions have staff that speak various languages. I know SEIU does a great job in organizing from within, and brings on staff people who speak Spanish, for instance, which is a large it was a large population of Spanish speaking people who work in janitorial and in the service industry, as you pointed out, the hotels and motels. I don't know what good the split does. I know that it's about how much money SEIU sends to the AFL-CIO and what they do with it. I believe politics are extremely important. There's a big difference in having a George Bush in office and somebody who's actually going to appoint people to the National Labor Relations Board who will take the position of working people. That being said, Bill Clinton wasn't the best president for unions, but he certainly wasn't Ronald Reagan or George Bush. But I don't think we've had a president, even when Roosevelt created the National Labor Relations Board, that was a whole that was a compromise. It was imperfect. But politics is what Sweeney wanted to put money in, and organizing is what SEIU wanted to put money in, and we got to have it in both.
Right.
I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, well, I don't see Stern and his group not putting money into politics. I mean,
do? SEIU actually put a ton of money in.
Right. You were just mentioning that they would talk to Keene, talk to Anastad, and all these people. These people want money, and they want it right up front. And no matter who it is, they have to have money to run their elections. And we've always in the past, always, the unions have always helped. I don't know how, but how much, you know.
Wait a minute. First got to pay dues to us so we can afford to have money to run an election for us to be given a title to run you. Doesn't that sort of like... Did Jimmy Hoffa say, first of all, I got to give me $100,000 so I can run a campaign that makes me the president when everybody agreed that he was the leader? I mean, or some such thing?
You guys have any cynic pills for Tom?
Yeah, no. When you put money into your dues, that's rank and file money. You know where that money's going to go. It's going to go to somebody to pay off somebody else to get something passed. Or at least have the power to help somebody, and that they know that they can come to you and say, hey, I'm going to need some help in my election. I'm going to need some help in my running it. And could you help me out? It's the same old story that you get everywhere. It doesn't just happen in business. It happens in unions.
I have another question about this union organization theme. For instance, take people like me. You know, I've been not in a union. The ones that are in the trade that I have excluded me. But is there a group out there that, we've been joking around about the IWW, where people can join, like going online and joining, where they can, the loose characters out there like me, can join a group that by just their membership gives a measurement of who is in favor of legal issue, or the legal and labor issues that would make some difference. In other words, is there a sort of like overall group that you can join?
Democratic Party.
Oh. Yeah, cheap shot.
Deny it. Why do you think Arnold Schwarzenegger? Why do you think the Republicans want to strangle unions? Because labor gives its money to the Democratic Party. Because the Democratic Party does more for any other political organization. Tom,
I actually worked for the Democratic Party, and let me tell you, it's that they don't represent. In labor, period. They may cadge votes from that group.
Really? Sheila Kuehl is a Democrat?
Oh, yeah, she's great. They're good Democrats.
Okay, only Democrats have voted in favor of Senate Bill 840, and every Republican has voted against it.
Well, I can tell you from inside experience, the Democratic Party represents the Democratic Party. It doesn't, and anybody that can cadge to get in, they don't represent the working man.
Well, let's put it this way. Our business manager used to be able to, when he wanted to, walk into Gray Davis's office and have an audience with the governor, not Schwarzenegger. So, you know, it is all about access.
No.
You wanted to meet. I mean, look, the political process is a process of assigning resources. Okay, it is what it is. The politicians need money to get elected. You know what? I'd rather that politician had labor's money than Wall Street's money.
Okay.
Better money coming from working people, so he at least has to pay attention to what gets said if he wants more money than money coming from the great, Wall of China, Mart.
I don't know if you can detect the disappointment in my voice.
Can I say something on that, Chuck? Chuck, the Democratic Party... yeah, truly is a voice for labor, has been in the past anyway. Recently, they've sort of bowed out, and Andy Stern's statement when he pulled out of the AFL-CIO was that, we're getting bombed by these Democrats who are caving in, and that we don't have to stay with the Democratic Party. He says there are some pretty good labor Republicans out there, maybe a few is all, he said. But he did say that we've got to quit kowtowing to Democrats and stick it to them to stand up for us, or we're going to bolt. And that's what I think has got everybody, the Democrats, scared to death, that this split will then take some money away from them.
I agree with what he said. So does our business manager, who's sticking with the AFL-CIO, made the same statement to at our last semi-annual meeting that, But the point is that labor always supports somebody who supports labor. And just because somebody has a big capital D behind their name, maybe they're not going to be there as much as you'd believe. And just because they have a big capital R behind their name, they're not necessarily a sycophant for Wall Street. But pretty much that's the way it is.
In the interests of disclosure, Chuck has a wonderful website that you can go to, the Yuba Sutter Democrats?
Well, it's yubasutterdemocrats.com, yeah.
.com. You go there and see some of his good writing. I think you're writing some of that stuff, aren't you?
I'm the web novice.
I'm the web novice. Anyway, so that just explains some of the point of view here.
Okay, thanks for allowing me to talk to you, Chuck.
Hey, Irv, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks.
Hey, thanks for contributing.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
We didn't treat that guest very well.
Well, the general manager of the radio station, you think you would have been nicer. You guys are still on, by the way.
We didn't treat him very well?
No. You guys are nice.
Oh, anyway, so although this next item is... what did I do?
Irv, call back. We want to treat you better.
Well, wait a minute. This is supposed to be a program of view and counterview. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, if we just espoused one particular point of view, only one group of people would listen to us.
You mentioned the website.
Your website, yes, that's a good one. So, and it's well put together too, by the way, I want to say.
Well, the great thing about the website is, particularly up in Yuba and Sutter counties, pretty much if you're a Democrat, they write these letters to the editor about you quoting scripture and telling how you're going to burn in hell. So pardon me if I believe that being a Democrat is a progressive and responsible position to take, because from my experience in Yuba and Sutter counties, if you don't belong to, for instance, the Glad Tidings Church, and you have you're not a Republican, then you pretty much can't be part of the power structure up there.
And
so it's actually very subversive to be a Democrat up in Yuba and Sutter County. So pardon me if I come to Bird Street in Oroville and all of a sudden I've got to be a what, Tom?
A what?
A what? You know, where do I need to be progressive on Bird Street in Oroville?
Oh, you got to be way further to the left than that.
Like what?
Well,
Tom?
You know the.
I want to belong to a union of people who actually have some, a chance to actually.
I mean, get something
gain control of the power structure.
There's little chance of that.
Chuck, can you put that website back out there again? What was it?
It's www.yubasutterdemocrats.com. Our lead story today is about that $20,000 for that eensy weensy affair that woman had with Arnold. By the way, he's a lot shorter than people think that he is. They understand that he has some lifts in his shoes. Everyone was going, "That's him?" when he walked into Paradiso. So it was pretty funny.
Well, anyway, I should point out that the viewpoints expressed on this station are those of the speaker and not necessarily those of the station. Irv would really like that, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we have some other stories here. This is one that is...
Getting more written by you, Tom?
Well, yeah, but actually what I'm really interested in is the part that I'm cribbing from somebody else, and I'm cribbing this from Eugene Robinson, New York Times. I'm asking, has he ever looked around? This is what he says on one of his stories on the web. It says, the pathological cable news obsession with young, attractive, white women who unfortunately vanish continues unabated. Yes, the nation is still transfixed by damsels in distress, only now it's gotten worse. The media are suddenly obsessed with their own obsession. Won't somebody please just make it stop? How silly of me. Of course, no one is going to make it stop. Certainly not Fox News anchor Greta Von Susteren, who spent so much time in Aruba looking for blonde, missing Natalie Holloway that she probably qualifies for a Dutch passport. Leaving no stone and sand dollar unturned, Van Susteren has ridden this sad little story to her best Nielsen ratings ever. Anyway, my comment on that was Robinson apparently hasn't noticed the 800-page paperback books in the grocery stand or gone to the cinema recently or watched TV movies. Women in Peril, as other critics have long termed this fair, has long been a staple of American literature and entertainment. The heroines heroines are generally white, youngish, slim, good-looking, stylishly dressed, and living either in a cosmopolitan city or some quaint vacation address.
You didn't add tied to the railroad track with the train coming
right.
down, yes.
Manhattan, L.A., or Malibu, Maine Coast, Florida Keys, etc. They're always portrayed as smarter and more attuned to psychic subtleties than their family and friends and husband. They are independently wealthy, or at least have no visible means of support, so they have time to have these adventures. They never have a regular job from which they can't take extended sabbaticals to solve life-threatening mysteries. The peril these women face, the trouble they get into, is never their fault. Friends, family, and authority figures never see the threat posed by mysterious strangers, weird husbands.
Unless, of course, they've been raped, because then society says it was their fault.
Oh, yes, I should have made that point. Roaming psychopaths, shadowy aliens, evil ghosts. These onlookers never pick up on the problem until the end. Those who do help generally get killed, except for if their aiding party is a kindly angel or a ghost from the past, leaving the heroine always triumphant with a hug for her boyfriend or husband or child who doubted them or the child they rescued. Some 80 or thereabouts percent of mass market novels are written by white women and bought by white women. The TV movie audiences are similarly dominated, but with many more teenage and early 20s girls thrown in. Why would television news, now owned by a handful of big dollar conglomerates looking for more money, be any different? That was my point. I'm really angry about that.
I have one comment.
What's that?
If they find Natalie Holloway, will Greta Van Susteren then move on to the search for Amelia Earhart?
That's a good point. The bones of Amelia. We have a couple more things we could talk about.
You know,
about.
It distracts, you know, that kind of news distracts everyone from, you know, what's going on. Did we get a constitution in Iraq today? Or did we find Natalie Holloway?
They're getting what's left of the one that we used to have before the Bush administration. No, I don't know. I understand.
We weren't using it anyway.
Yeah, right. Did you bring along a story or two you want to talk about? Because I've got a few more, but I don't want to. You've been very a very good guest here, and despite my...
you have a whole stack there. Keep going.
Well, some of these are just the same story over many times. We've been talking about how bad the business end of government is. Let's talk about how bad the government is itself. There's a great little story. I'm not going to read all of it. This is from AP again. The reporter is Tom Hayes. And it all has to do with Smile. You're in New York City. Is the surveillance of the public that has increased so much since 2001. Six surveillance cameras could be seen peering out from a chain drugstore on Broadway, that's New York City. One protruded awkwardly from the awning of a fast food restaurant, a supersized domed version hovering over a flying saucer outside Columbia University. To the dismay of civil libertarians and with the approval of law enforcement, they've been multiplying at a dizzying rate all over the nation. And we get out here that at last count in 1998, in London, British police used videotape from some of their underground systems, 6,000 cameras, to help identify the suicide bombers on July 7th and the suspects in a failed attack on July 21. But as the bombings showed, the cameras do not deter determined attackers. At last count in 1998, the New York Civil Liberties Union found 2,397 cameras used by a wide variety of private businesses and government agencies throughout Manhattan. Now, Manhattan is only 6 miles long, so you can imagine how that is, and was then in 1998 before the big boom in surveillance cameras. This time, after canvassing less than a quarter of the borough, that's Manhattan, the interns so far have spotted more than 4,000 spying cameras focused on the public. The preliminary total only provides a glimpse of the magnitude of the problem, said NYNCLU Executive Director Donna Lieberman. Nobody has a clue how many there really are.
Two things are happening, Tom. First off, you started out that comment by pointing out you wanted to show how bad government is. Most of those cameras are owned by private businesses, and it also reflects the lowering cost of the technology to have the cameras.
Yes, but it's management working in cahoots with the government that is.
Oh no, we're all being spied on. Yeah, but it's corporate America again.
Anyway, the police officers already watch live feeds from hundreds of cameras in city housing projects throughout the five boroughs, where they are a proven deterrent, said NYPD spokesman Paul Brown. Elsewhere, Chicago recently spent roughly $5 million on a 2,000 camera system, which has been credited for reducing crime to its lowest point in some 40 years. Yes, right, I'm sure.
If somebody steals a car and it's not caught on camera, is it a crime?
Can you rephrase that? I didn't quite. That was about.
Well, it's like the bear in the woods sort of. Tree falls in the woods sort of thing.
Oh, yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, well, what'll do is they'll have the visual but not this audio. Along the same lines.
But it didn't happen. I don't know why you want to report a crime. We didn't catch it on camera. It couldn't have happened.
Well, how did we ever convict, or at least ostensibly convict, Clinton of his dalliance? Nobody saw that either. Gene J. Koprowski, and where he wrote this, I can't tell because I didn't include it. On August 12th, wrote
this. There wasn't a conviction.
There was an
allegation by
not proved,
the House. Yes.
Not proved. A controversial plan to embed radio frequency identification chips in license plates, the ones in your car, in the United Kingdom, also may be coming to the United States. Experts told UPI's Wireless World the so-called E-plate, developed by the British firm Hills Number Plates, is a license plate that also transmits a vehicle's unique identification via encryption that can be read by a small detector whose output can be used locally or communicated to a distant host. RFID is all the rage these days, said Bradley Gross, chairman of Becker and Polyakov, a law firm in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. But my fear is that this use of the technology is tracking it at its worst. The reason for the concern in the legal and privacy rights communities is that e-plates may expand the ability of police to track individuals by the movement of their vehicles. A single RFID reader can identify dozens of vehicles fitted with e-plates moving at any speed.
Now, Tom, why should you worry about this unless you're a criminal?
Oh, they've captured that.
I mean, you know, my goodness. Shouldn't people know where we are at all times? I have a cell phone here that has GPS in it. My employer, from what I understand, can go back and run a program for a month that'll show all my movements.
But you know why that is? I've been reading about that. It isn't so much to know where you are. It's so that later on, if you were to raise a complaint, they go back and review it to see if they can find something that could be used as a countercharge.
We had a situation in the Bay Area where a parks maintenance worker was accused of not being at his job site when he was supposed to be. And it was all related to GPS in his vehicle. Well, and they went back to in processing the grievance. You know, they fired him and he appealed it, and because of subpoena powers, we were able to get copies of the the GPS reports. And it turns out that the GPS actually showed that he was parked at the same intersection for 48 hours. When in fact
exactly.
He'd been home, and I mean, so the technology's imperfect, but this notion of keeping track of us is, there's been discussion of implanting chips inside your arm, so they know who you are at all times, and
my take on this is this: as in all these benefits that they create for themselves, they don't realize how they can eventually be turned against them. For instance, if Marianne and I were married and we're going through a divorce, anything that's recorded.
Wait a minute, you're not even married yet and you're getting a divorce? That was the.
Story of my life.
If But for instance, if we were to be going through a divorce, anything that can be recorded can be subpoenaed. So if these guys who are espousing this sort of thing don't realize that should they get into an adversarial legal issue, their movements can then be subpoenaed. And if they find them parked in front of the same address down by the whorehouse in downtown Oroville, then they've got something they use against you. So it's not in anybody's interest to have their movements recorded all the time, even though you may not be committing a crime.
This is all part of the Malthus theory.
Which theory is that? Because there are two. That's the population one.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, what happens is that, you know, the population increases to a point that where all the individuals in the population start, killing each other. The first thing you need to know is where everybody is.
Yeah, if you're going to kill somebody, you got to know where to point the gun.
You're going to keep track of them. What are they doing? You know, this is all an outgrowth of the carrying capacity of the earth. I mean, we're going to get less and less freedom when we get more and more people.
Well, what's interesting about this is, among other things, is that you can't see these chips in your plate, and they don't have to tell you when they put them in. And so we could have them right now. We don't, I believe, in California, but they could make an administrative move to place the chips in the California plates and
I doubt
after you've kind of figured out what's going on and subpoenaed that information.
I doubt that it would be an administrative move, or at least it wouldn't be one that lasted very long.
Well, not only that, but, for instance, if chips are that small and so easily attached, then the government doesn't have to do it. Your employer can go out and put one on the back of your plate, and you'll never know. You'll know where you are.
Well, they can.
Total surveillance is not a good society.
Well, your employer can't put it on your vehicle.
Wives, children. I mean, you know, like, I mean, would you, this is just, you know.
I think
a parent right now would like to put one of those chips on their daughter's license plate and know where she's going and which cars are parked next to her.
I'm one of them.
Oh, really? Oh, I wasn't referring to you. Honestly, no. Chuck has a daughter, a stepdaughter, a gorgeous 17. Oh, yes, and a really talented girl that half the community has fallen in love with, or should have by now, and very talented, as I said. Anyway,
she has a Save the Planet, Vote Democratic bumper sticker on the back of her car.
I bet, yeah.
That she put there. Anyways, imagine.
So guess what excuse they're using to put these chips in your plate? It will stop terrorism. Crush. Anyway, let's see what else we got here.
But that is terrorism, what they want to do.
Okay, we're getting towards the end, and I always try to save something that I like for the last. And this is from the BBC News, as most of my news is. Experts decipher Inca strings. Researchers in the U.S. believe they have come closer to solving a centuries-old mystery by deciphering knotted string used by the ancient Incas. Experts say one bunch of knots appears to identify a city, marking the first intelligible word from the extinct South American civilization. The colored knotted pieces of string, known as quipu, are believed to have been used for accounting information. The researchers say the finding could unlock the meaning of other quipu. Harvard University researchers Gary Erton and Kerry Brazine used computers to analyze 21 quipu. That's spelled K-H-I-P-U. They found a three-knot pattern in some of the strings, which they believe identifies this bunch as coming from the city of Puruchico, the site of the Inca Palace. We hypothesize that the arrangement of three figure-eight knots at the start of these quipu represented the place identifier or toponym, Puruchico. They wrote in their report published in the journal Science. We suggest that any quipu moving within the state administrative system bearing an initial arrangement of three figure eight knots would have been immediately recognizable to Inca administrators as an account pertaining to the palace of Puruchico. Most experts agree that quipu representing an accounting system, but until now, no one had been able to decipher them. Now, I think that's interesting. You can't see it on radio, but I have a picture of those, and they're several strings, maybe like 10 or so, hanging from another string. And when I looked at it, it reminded me of the curls in the head of the Predator in Alien and Predator. And I was thinking, you know, that really does tell you how Alien is, how everything can be the same, but the whole system, the whole civilization can be completely alien.
I understand
what
that,
you think.
I understand that, you know, the Spaniards thought they were just scalps. And then they just rediscovered them, and that they might actually have this this meaning. They thought that they were taken off the heads of people and just scalps.
Oh, really? Well, the see, that's why we have people like Chuck Smith on this station. He knows something, which is more than we can say for Dan and I. Anyway, you've been listening to Left Turn on Bird Street on KRBS 107.1 Low Power FM in Oroville, California. This is a great day for our program here. We got WebStream, thanks to Marianne Irv and many other people who contributed to this.
And Jim Thomas, he definitely deserves some thanks because he is... pretty much found all the programming we that we're running, and he's built the computers that we're working. So thank you, Jim Thomas, for making all this available to us. And yeah, live web streaming. You can go to the site. We have the button there right on the front page of the website. You can go right to it. Hopefully we won't have to turn it off. We're going to do it until the money runs out. So hopefully we'll be doing it for a while.
Speaking of which, money, how would people give money in order to help this continue?
You know, there are numerous ways to give the money.
Is there a special web streams fund?
There's a... Well, no, there's not.
It's just the station
PayPal.
In general.
There's the station in general, yeah. We do have PayPal set up on our website. You can go through PayPal. Or you can stop by the station, 2076 Bird Street, or give us a call. We'll mail you something, 534-1200. Or you could mail us something, P.O. Box 9, Oroville, California, 95965.
Is it also going to be archived? Do you know?
We are going to work on archiving, yeah, because Live 365 offers an archiving system. So as soon as we figure out how to do that, yeah, we'll have at least 24 hours of programming archived, and we're going to also try and link samples on our website on each of the programmer's page. So we are little bits and pieces here and there. We're putting it together to make it accessible to the world.
Now, is there a minimum acceptable donation, or will you take pennies?
Oh, heck no, we take it all. Take it all. I would also like to make sure that Tom lets you know about his website, Left Turn on Bird Street. Lots of hits. I was doing some Googling last night and kept popping up all over the place with information on little comments that you guys have made. When you Google something, I don't know what the heck I was Googling, you know, but I just kept getting hits on Left Turn on Bird Street.
We're actually making friends with some of the people who have been leaving the remarks on our comments, some of which have been intelligent, many of which have not. And but we develop relationships even with the people who are dumb, because they're fruitful for jokes.
That's how I got here.
No, hardly. Anyway, we're hoping to talk to you again. It's getting right towards the end of our time, is it not? Or am I
five minutes?
Oh, 5 minutes. Oh, see, I did this.
But I have a 3-minute song though. So if you only want to talk for two, I'm covered.
Well, no, I had some other stories to do, but is there some topic, Chuck, that's labor-related that we haven't explored that you'd like to recap or to...
Well, yeah, actually, in Yuba and Sutter counties on Labor Day, there's a...
That's the coming up one, though.
Coming up. There's a new coalition called the Public Employee Appreciation Committee, which is a mouthful, but it says PEAK. You know, you got to come up with an acronym, but...
Consideration spelled with a K?
Yeah, no, with a C.
Oh.
At any rate, 1 in 4 people who earn a paycheck in Yuba and Sutter counties is a public employee, the state, local, state, or federal employee. And so the significance to the economy up there is great. And so if you have a coffee shop or a shoe store or something up in Marysville, Yuba City... you know, it'd be important for you not to badmouth the public employees, because it could be, you know, 1 out of every 4 of your customers. So we're going to have, anyway, this event is going to be on Labor Day from 11 to 4 at...
That Monday?
That Monday at Gaucher Park in Yuba City. And we're hoping to, out of that, be able to develop some activists in among the public employee sector, which, believe it or not, is at least 50% Republican, even though Republicans would, you know, just as soon fire them all.
You know, what's really interesting is that I covered city and county government for many years, and the state government too, and this less applies to them. I've always been surprised that people do get so angry at government workers in the local levels because they do so much. Some of the most devoted people, Fred Davis in Chico, many years, a brilliant city administrator. I mean, and they paid him a little bit, or quite a bit, I guess, but did a fabulous job for people. And what was never got compliments. Only got he kept that city running. And kept the council informed. There are other, at every level, you find in each office, many people are sort of average, but there's a few people in there that make things go that are really helpful. And I've always sort of liked government workers myself.
Well, in the North State, they make about,
few of them.
They make, you know, two-thirds of statewide average for, I'm not statewide average for all jobs. So they're not overpaid. They are an important part of the community, both economically, but also for what they do. Again, they treat your wastewater, they treat your drinking water, they fix your roads. They may be taking care of your grandma if she's involved in in-home health care system. And talk about a group of people that get abused. That's the in-home health care workers.
That's right, working long hours with hardly any money.
Yeah.
Even just my work within the welfare department, I was amazed. These people work their butt off, and I don't care. I mean, they may be have decent wages for this area, but the wages still are not that great.
Mm-hmm.
But they are basically getting sick to do their job on a day-to-day basis. I found the majority of the employees stressed out because of overworked and ill. So, yeah, I have major support for any of the public workers.
Except for the once and again dunderheads that may crop up here and there as any workable.
Oh, yeah.
There's Tom looking for that perfect world.
Hey, listen, I've worked hard to make this a perfect world.
That example that
I would like to say hello to KQRP, Low Power Radio Station in Salida, California, because they just picked up Left Turn on Bird Street. They will now be broadcasting replays of this show down in Salida.
Hello,
hey,
Salida.
Brad.
I really like the WKRP as in WQRP as opposed to WKRP, one of my all-time favorite programs. Baby, have you ever, you know?
Then I could find it.
No, I like that. We always enjoy having an affiliate that listened that for LTOBS, Left Turn on Bird Street. We are now coast to coast and worldwide.
You can visit their website, Brad Johnson's website, at www.kqrp.com and see what his low power station is doing.
And our Pennsylvania station.
Hello, Salida.
Is that Salida?
Or Salida. Yeah, I don't know. All right. Well, I guess we are leaving. See you later, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up next is Quiet. Whoops. Quiet Tunes with Liana, followed by Lee with Classic Country Time.
I've read the words before, so now I know. Time has come again for me, and I'm feeling the same way. Day that I can't find my hand, my feet don't look like they're my own. I try and find the floor below to stand. I hope I reach it once again.